Hello, on this week's program, Susan Lewis considers why Chopin's music appeals to ballet choreographers as Pennsylvania Ballet stages a trio of works to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the 19th century composer's birth. As part of celebrations of Samuel Barber's centenary, David Patrick Stearns looks ahead to performances by Curtis Opera Theatre of his Antony and Cleopatra. Tom Keels previews Philadelphia on Stone, a new exhibition at the Library Company of Philadelphia, exploring how local lithographers have depicted their city from the 1800s to the present day. And we speak with Janice Mays and Irene Malloy, stars of Frank McCourt's The Irish and How They Got That Way, at the Kimmel Center's Innovation Studio. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
For nearly two centuries, Frédéric Chopin has been engaging pianists with his lyrical melodies, distinctive rhythms, and complex harmonies. But Chopin's music has also inspired ballet. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers his appeal to choreographers as Pennsylvania Ballet presents a trio of works set to the music of Chopin.
Why does Chopin's music work so well with ballet? Everything Chopin wrote was for piano, most of it for the solo instrument, and much of it quite demanding to play. Just ask Pennsylvania Ballet solo pianist Martha Kahneman.
He strikes fear in my heart, particularly etudes. Sometimes there are huge, huge intervals between notes that have to be spanned smoothly and in velvet fashion in one hand and at a rapid rate of speed.
At times, highly embellished melodies are expected to sound light and airy.
So light that it's like a little breeze blew it by and it just fluttered. When all is going well, it flows in an incredibly relaxing way, a very lyrical, rounded, full way. And it sounds completely natural. It sounds as easy as speaking.
Part of what makes the music work so well for classical ballet is that there is generally a very natural meter to the music.
Pennsylvania Ballet's artistic director, Roy Kaiser, suggests that Chopin's logical progression appeals to choreographers in an art form that, like Chopin's music, makes highly skilled movements appear effortless.
While the technique is not always the most natural thing that the human body has been asked to do, movement is. Movement is very, very natural, and I find that a lot of Chopin's music is very natural. It sounds like it comes from a very natural, organic place.
There is also a certain intimacy, says Pennsylvania Ballet music director Beatrice Afrin, especially with a solo piano, which is what you'd hear in a rehearsal.
And so in performance, when one hears a piano alone in particular, it kind of has that sense of sort of being behind the scenes or being in the sort of everyday world of the dancer.
But Chopin, who sometimes did include other instruments, has also been transcribed for other instruments. In this weekend's production, Pennsylvania Ballet is performing three very different works, Jerome Robbins' In the Night and The Concert, and choreographer-in-residence Matthew Neenan's work, The Crossed Line, which originally premiered in 2004, when Neenan stumbled, probably not the right word for a ballet dancer, on a treasure trove of Chopin while preparing a workshop with the New York City Ballet Choreographic Institute.
I found all this really great Chopin music, some of it that I had never heard before, and I don't know if it was because it was transcribed, but it didn't sound like Chopin at all to me.
Neenan discovered his affinity for this 19th century master, and after the workshop, wanted to create a larger work, using pieces for piano and violin, and piano and cello.
So I just chose more selections, read up on him a little bit more, and once I started to hear about his life, and then when you really hear the music, it just took on a whole new meaning.
Chopin's life was short, ending at age 39 from complications from tuberculosis, but musically intense. He was born in Poland and raised in Warsaw, where he played piano and was recognized early as a star. As a young man, Chopin went to Paris, taking up with what Jeffrey Kahlberg, chair of the Department of Music at the University of Pennsylvania, describes as a community of like-minded performers and artists, including the female writer who took the name George Sand, with whom he had an extended love affair. Pianists at the time, says Kahlberg, typically performed their own music.
Paris was kind of the mecca for these pianist composers, and there were a lot of émigrés from different parts of Europe, Liszt being one of them initially, but the people like Frederick Kalkbrenner and Theodor Derle, people we tend to forget these days. And Chopin fit in with these, but what really set him apart was the extraordinary quality of what he composed.
While he's classified as part of the Romantic period, Chopin disdained the program music of the time that followed a storyline. Kahlberg says Chopin preferred the craft and counterpoint of Bach and Mozart to the styles of his musical contemporaries, and is celebrated for the new possibilities he drew out of the piano. He'd allow sounds to blur together, looking forward to Debussy, even in an early work like his Nocturne in C-sharp minor, used by Jerome Robbins for In the Night.
Which is a work that, unlike most nocturnes, seems not to have a really lyrical melody at the beginning. What you have is a melody that moves scarcely at all, and what you hear is just chords undulating and a mood being set without any melody to hang on to. So he was rethinking what forms and genres were about by putting emphasis on new kinds of sounds.
While many of Chopin's works, his polonaises, mazurkas, and waltzes, were based on dance, he never wrote specifically for ballet. But his music has long inspired creators of dance, among them innovative Russian choreographer Mikhail Fokine, who chose Chopin's music for his 1909 romantic work, Les Sylphides. Around the same time, Chopin's music also played a part in bringing together Ballet Russe founder Sergei Diaghilev and Stravinsky, when Diaghilev asked the composer to arrange pieces of Chopin for the ballet. The partnership became one of the greatest in classical ballet, resulting in masterworks like The Firebird and The Rite of Spring. Pennsylvania Ballet's program this weekend illustrates how choreographers can mirror the mood of the music or play against it. The nocturnes of In the Night are described by Pennsylvania Ballet artistic director Roy Kaiser as beautiful and haunting, a perfect complement to Jerome Robbins' dance.
No plot line, but three very definite and definitive emotional stories.
In contrast, Robbins' work The Concert is a comedic ballet set at a piano recital of serious music. Pennsylvania Ballet's pianist Martha Kahneman is on stage, where she is both performer and accompanist for the dancers in the roles of the audience members around her.
As a player, I don't feel held back in any way. And the humor, of course, is built in beautifully in the choreography, but there's a little bit of adjustment that you can give in the music to heighten the comic effect. obviously Chopin was not interested in producing laughs when he wrote his nocturnes or the Berceuse, certainly, but there are things that you can do to heighten the comedy.
Comedy, mystery, passion, and human drama. 2 centuries after his birth, Chopin continues to inspire young forward-looking choreographers today, like Matthew Neenan, who found the 19th century composer's music to be the perfect vehicle to explore the bold choices we make and the boundaries we may encounter, and choose, perhaps, to cross.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Pennsylvania Ballet's All Chopin program includes Jerome Robbins' In the Night and The Concert, and Matthew Neenan's The Crossed Line. Performances are tonight and tomorrow afternoon at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The members of the orchestra have now taken their places, and Mr. Toscanini is returning to the center of the stage. We shall hear these 2 pieces by Samuel Barber, Adagio for strings and Essay for orchestra.
History was made in this 1938 radio broadcast featuring the first ever performance of Samuel Barber's Adagio for strings, which is now one of the most beloved orchestral pieces of the 20th century. The Westchester-born composer, whose 100th birthday was this week, began his career at the top. As a recent graduate of the Curtis Institute of Music, Barber sent the famous Toscanini his Adagio, got it back without a single marking, and believed he'd been rejected. In fact, the conductor had memorized the music and scheduled a performance. A much more evolved Barber, however, fell from grace some 30 years later when his opera Antony and Cleopatra bombed at the 1966 opening of the Metropolitan Opera House. That's the piece the Curtis Opera Theatre is hoping to rehabilitate with a production at the Kimmel Center's Paramount Theatre that opens on Wednesday and has been sold out since July. Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns reports.
What went wrong that fateful night in 1966 when the Metropolitan Opera House opened its doors with a lavish Franco Zeffirelli production of a new Samuel Barber opera? Were audiences and critics not ready for this bracing opening chorus from a composer best known for wistful nostalgia? Or were they not able to take it in with so much to look at on stage? Whatever the case, it's generally agreed that Antony and Cleopatra's reputation as one of the great flops of the lyric stage, an Edsel among operas, is not warranted. The composer went back to work on it in 1974 with the help of his ex-partner Giancarlo Minotti. That should have helped more than it did. Maybe the world, not the opera, needed to change a bit to embrace Barber as someone whose music is more than just pleasant. In fact, the Curtis Productions conductor George Manahan believes Antony and Cleopatra could have more staying power than Barber's now more popular works.
I would hope that this performance here at Curtis is going to be the beginning of a revival of this piece. I think it's got value, it's beautiful. Obviously, the libretto is so strong. And I do not understand why it's not produced. There are so many charismatic sopranos that could sing this role, and the role of Antony is, I would think, a dream for a bass baritone.
Manahan is based at the New York City Opera and conducted a concert version of Antony and Cleopatra last season at Carnegie Hall. He believes the opera is more dramatically adept than the original Shakespeare play from which the libretto is drawn. However, some critics have wondered over the years if Shakespeare is part of the problem. When sung rather than spoken, the words can lose their theatrical impact. More than most Shakespeare plays, this one is loaded with Elizabethan idioms and references that one of the original cast members, Ezio Flagello, worried about openly in a pre-performance radio interview on the opera's opening night in 1966.
As a matter of fact, I thought you might put footnotes in the programs as to what the words meant, because it is very difficult. But we are trying our best.
The music was typical of the tougher, less compromising Barber of that time, as is the case with his piano concerto, which had won him his second Pulitzer Prize. But there was so much more of that in the opera. You'd expect the high point of the story to be a love duet, but there wasn't one. Though the composer was considered hopelessly retro in avant-garde circles, he had created a hugely original effect when Mark Antony falls on his sword, one that's best described by conductor Manahan.
The whole scene is accompanied by timpani, four kettle drums, and every once in a while a piccolo coming in with this very sad little lament. And that's the two singers and the two instruments for the whole scene.
You wonder how any opera with a scene this strong could possibly fail, or for that matter, anything that starred Leontine Price at her vocal peak. And there came another surprise. The opera asked the now legendary soprano to sing at the lower end of her range, from which she created a characterization that was declaimed as much as sung, showing a more political, less seductive Cleopatra. It was one of several secondary elements that conspired to create distance between the listeners and the opera. In the 1974 revision, which conductor Manahan witnessed as a young rehearsal pianist at the Juilliard School, Barber was back from a five-year self-imposed exile in Italy to recover from the trauma of failure. He was a changed man. The younger Barber was the most presentable of composers, hobnobbing with artists and movie stars, even if, when the heavy-drinking Tallulah Bankhead showed up at his parties, he reportedly locked himself in the bathroom. Post-Antony and Cleopatra, Barber was quieter. He joked mildly about giving up composing in favor of deep-sea diving. Barber was suffering from what was later revealed to be depression and alcoholism, even if, according to Manahan, he hit it fairly well.
I think I picked up on that depression, and perhaps I was saying feeble. He seemed much older than he actually was to me.
For the 1974 version, Barber did end up writing a love duet, and a fine one at that.
In other ways, I wonder if he sold his opera down the river. Most Barbara watchers believed that the revision is a less sprawling improvement, but to my ears, it's something that can be heard at a safer distance and performed in a manner that's more typically operatic. There we have that word again, distance. How is Barbara best played? In the slow, pretty, reflective manner? In interviews, Barbara longed for a bit more speed. Though he'd heard his adagio for strings performed by many people in high places, his favorite performance was the long, unreleased 1938 premiere with its particularly transcendent climax. Transcendent is perhaps the key word with Barber. Though his music often conjures familiar images, whether of small-town America or ancient Egypt, the introverted composer was in fact exploring an inner world, something more deceptively private than, say, Aaron Copland's. Is it possible that the composer who fled to Italy during that stressful time and to the bathroom when Tallulah Bankhead came to call was always creating a beautiful, if artificial, world into which he and his listeners could retreat until even this retreat was no longer safe?
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. He writes about Samuel Barber in tomorrow's paper. The now sold-out performances of Curtis Opera Theatre's production of Antony and Cleopatra are at the Perelman Theatre at the Kimmel Centre on Wednesday and Friday evening and on next Sunday afternoon. Philographica 2010 is the first annual Philadelphia-wide celebration of the role of print in contemporary art. But the city has been a printmaking pioneer since its days as the workshop of the world, as Tom Keels discovered when he visited a new exhibition at the Library Company of Philadelphia.
In the early 19th century, Philadelphia was both the creative and scientific capital of America, home to artists like Charles Wilson Peale and engineers like Benjamin Henry Latrobe. Art and science merged in 1819 when a local painter created the first lithographic print in the United States, says Erica Piola, assistant curator of prints and photographs at the Library Company of Philadelphia.
Lithography is a first associated with Philadelphia, with Bass Otis, who was a portrait artist in Philadelphia. He created the first American lithograph in 1819. The actual process was discovered circa 1798 in Bavaria, but Philadelphia was the first city where an actual lithograph was produced in America.
Initially, the appeal of the new printing process was limited to painters and scientists who used it to reproduce artwork or technical illustrations. The first commercial lithographer did not open his doors in Philadelphia until 1828, but the new technique quickly revolutionized the city's printing industry. Lithography was faster and cheaper than engraving, a laborious process which involved carving images onto a metal or wooden surface.
It's a planographic printing process. You're writing with a special crayon or special ink on a stone. And because of that, it allowed for larger print runs than engraving. A copper plate or a wood block would start to wear down. So with lithograph, you'd get thousands of impressions from the same stone, which wasn't really possible with a copper plate or a wood block.
Beginning Thursday, the Library Company of Philadelphia will explore how local lithographers depicted their city in a new exhibit called Philadelphia on Stone, the first 50 years of commercial lithography in Philadelphia, 1828 to 1878. Linda Wisniewski, print department assistant at the Library Company, believes that the prints on display document Philadelphia's evolution into a great industrial and mercantile metropolis during this time.
But it's also pride in the city, too, in these new buildings going up and the booming industry. It does say a lot about Philadelphia's pride, and I don't know that you hear that so much anymore. We were a city comparable to New York, and I think that kind of shows as well.
Lithography became the primary advertising medium of the age, especially after the introduction of chromolithography, or colored lithographs, in the 1850s. Erica Piola says these advertisements usually showed a business's physical location rather than what it produced or sold.
And at that time, you're not really showing any products so much. You showed the business where you could get the product.
For instance, the lithograph for the McCalla Hat and Cap Manufactory at 252 Market Street shows little headgear. The focus is on the workers and customers thronging the three-story brick building, its inventory-packed storeroom, and the boxes waiting to be loaded on the horse-drawn wagon parked out front. Jeffrey Ray, senior curator at the Atwater Kent Museum, sees these lithographs as going beyond promoting individual businesses to celebrate the dynamic new city.
Philadelphia was very much in the midst of the change of the American economy from agricultural to manufacturing and commercial. The images that you see of the city are of a vital city with the streets with people on them, with the sidewalks with people there, and of really active commercial interest going on.
And Philadelphia's artistic heritage gave its lithographs a unique aesthetic quality, despite their commercial nature.
There was a genuine effort to create these images that had clouds that looked like real clouds in them, that the streets looked like real streets. It has produced a visual record of the city that I don't think is equal to any other American city.
The exhibition, Philadelphia on Stone, delves into diaries and personal records to uncover what daily life was like for 19th century lithographers. While a few entrepreneurs like P.S. Duval prospered, most journeyman printers struggled to survive financially. Among them was Morris Trobel, whose story was pieced together by Linda Wisniewski from documents in the Library of Congress.
And he operated a shop in Philadelphia. You know, we discovered that he had committed suicide in 1898, I believe, and the papers talked about his financial troubles quite frequently, how he had to rely on his son and how he had to constantly borrow money. But you get that sense in the papers that it was a financially difficult trade, but it's one that he stuck with.
Commercial lithography reached its peak during the 1876 centennial, when thousands of prints celebrated Philadelphia's magnificent World's Fair. But by 1900, advertisers had turned to photographs and line drawings, relegating lithography to its original role as an artistic medium. Erica Piola included works by two contemporary printmakers, Kip Deeds and Roberta Delaney, in the exhibit to show the continuing influence of lithography on the graphic arts.
19th century lithography in Philadelphia still has an influence on 21st century. For instance, Kip Deeds, he uses historical themes in his lithographs. And Roberta Delaney, you can sort of see in the work that's going to be in the exhibit, the framing techniques that she used are similar to framing techniques that they used in 19th century lithography.
For Piola, the heart of the exhibition consists of its early commercial lithographs, which recreate the colorful yet chaotic vitality of 19th century Philadelphia.
There's still a charm to the lithographs of the 19th century and the Philadelphia work. And, you know, I hope that also is coming out through the exhibition, that sometimes it is this kind of garish coloring, but I kind of still appreciate the garish coloring. I don't mind their grittiness or crudeness because I think that's sort of Philadelphia in its own way.
Philadelphia on Stone is the most visible element of a multi-stage enterprise spearheaded by the Library Company in partnership with other archival institutions. Plans are underway for an online catalog of more than 800 prints of the city, an illustrated biographical dictionary of early lithographers, and a collection of essays. Together, these projects will demonstrate how commercial lithography painted an indelible portrait of Philadelphia during its heyday as the workshop of the world.
WRTI's Tom Keels. Philadelphia on Stone opens at the Library Company of Philadelphia on Thursday and runs through October 15th as part of Philographica 2010, the first citywide celebration of the role of print in contemporary art. Our next story takes us out of the studio and into the Kimmel Center's Innovation Studio. The Irish and How They Got That Way began life at the Irish Repertory Theatre in New York in the late 1990s. It was written by the late Frank McCourt, the celebrated author of Angela's Ashes, Tiz, and Teacher Man. Since then, the two-hour review in Song and Story of the Irish and the Irish-American Experience in History has had a surprisingly long afterlife. The piece features six performers, three men and three women, recounting in words and music the British oppression of the Irish, the potato famine, and the subsequent mass waves of immigration to the United States and around the world, Irish contributions to American society as soldiers, statesmen, entertainers, and ne'er-do-wells, are told and retold with McCourt's trademark humour and irreverence. A production here at the Kimmel Centre features Janice Mays and Irie Molloy. Both of you have Irish backgrounds. Irie Molloy, the most obvious from your name. You had quite an experience of your Irish background from your grandfather. So even coming into the show, you knew some of the songs.
Yes, I knew many of the songs. I actually was raised on many of the songs. So it was what really appealed to me about doing the project was being able to sing those songs again, being able to play those songs on the guitar and the dulcimer, and being able to share the Irish story and, you know, have my grandparents come and my Molloy relatives, of which there are many. It's a large clan, the Molloys.
It's one of those things, Janice, that could have been carried off badly, but isn't. It's not. There's a little bit of sentimentality in it, but it's not in any way hokey. Mm-hmm. When you first looked at it, what convinced you to take the part?
Well, I didn't know much about it, actually, before doing it. I do come from an Irish background as well, though, and so the thought of something written by Frank McCourt and, you know, being able to do something that's part of my heritage was very appealing to me as well.
We should mention that you actually graduated from school in 2008. Is this the first big role you've had?
No, actually, last year I did a show off-Broadway, Dear Edwina. That was the first thing after graduating and moving to New York. Got in that quite quickly. That was great.
And you're a more seasoned, shall we say, seasoned actor in that you've done more than what about 95% of all actors do, which is work constantly. Do you offer advice to Janice, or is she the competition?
You know, I don't know what advice I have to offer. You know, I definitely enjoy sharing my stories and experiences and enjoy being around such young, talented, excited, exuberant people.
We should say that you're not 35 or anywhere near that yet.
No, I'm not ancient yet. But I did a lot when I was young. You know, I packed a lot into my early years. So I do have some good stories to tell. And I think we all sort of share our experiences of, you know, I never got to go to college for 4 years for theater. So I like to learn a lot from them about what that's like, because I was sort of living the college of hard knocks out on the road of life when I was in the college years. So we're all sort of sharing our experiences with each other. And it's been a really, really gratifying experience in that way.
We're coming up on St. Patrick's Day, so clearly the show will be busy in the coming week and probably in the days after. Let me ask each of you individually, Janice first, to tell me why I should come and see the show if I'm not Irish or Irish-American.
Well, first of all, it is very entertaining, and it's wonderful. The stories are wonderful. It's a very uplifting story. All the things that the Irish people went through and the way that they triumphed throughout all the hardships. And, you know, we end the show with naming some of the really great names of Irish people who have changed the world. Presidents, authors, people that anyone will recognize.
And some ne'er-do-wells as well.
Yes, exactly. So I think that in itself is just going to appeal to anyone. And I know plenty of people have come to see it who aren't Irish. My cousins lived in England, and they came to see it, and they loved it. And
did they feel ashamed at any point?
I didn't ask them, but they said they weren't offended, so that was nice.
And Irene, you, how would this appeal to a Polish-American or an African-American or an Italian-American?
I think the story is something that people can relate to because, let's face it, Americans are made up of immigrants anyway. And most immigrants don't have the easiest time coming here because, you know, you have to pay your dues and in a lot of cases go through a lot of struggle to live the quote-unquote American dream, whatever that is anymore. But the story is universal. I think they might learn something. I think they might enjoy the music and seeing the people around them singing the music and crying to the music and clapping to the music and laughing at the way that the Irish people can laugh at themselves is I think, a beautiful thing.
Janice Mays and Irene Molloy, stars of The Irish and How They Got That Way. It runs Thursday through Sunday on April 18th at the Kimmel Center's Innovation Studio. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under Rossin Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.